world's most influential voices are driving the thought leadership and change necessary to take action and reduce the threat and severity of climate change. Join me, Roger Platt, president of the U.S. Green Building Council, as I speak to environmental leaders about the impact of the built environment when it comes to solutions to climate change on my podcast series, Climate Leaders. Today, we're very happy to have with us Dave René, who is with the International Solar Energy Society. And by that, I should say that he is their president of their board, and is the driving force at the moment behind an organization that has been plowing the fields of the solar energy policy world for a very long time. And he will have a very interesting perspective on the most recent developments, not only in Paris at the COP, but also the intersection of solar power issues and poverty eradication and other crucial global issues that are priorities for the Solar Energy Society. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Roger. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I think the first thing that would be really helpful for our listeners and those who are really tracking the evolution of solar as it relates to both the lead up to the Paris COP agreement and now the fact that we have an agreement, is just to hear a little bit more about the International Solar Energy Society itself, how it was formed, what it's doing now, and just very briefly, where you see it going, just so that we can orient with this really interesting organization. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. The International Solar Energy Society actually has its roots back to 1954, which is the same year that Bell Labs patented the first commercial solar panel, a PV system. There are a number of scientists that were working on this technology. They got together and felt like an organization was needed to help promote this technology for further research as well as for commercialization. The society in the formation of the society took place in Phoenix, Arizona, and they had this first conference in Phoenix in 1955, I believe. In 1970, the International Solar Energy Society was formed, with the American Solar Energy Society becoming its first section. So both have roots back to 1954 in that regard. And then ISIS has continued to operate from an international perspective since 1970, promoting still the research and development and deployment of solar technologies in particular, but other renewable technologies as well. And ISIS has been serving very effectively in that role here in the U.S. And then over the years, a number of other sections formed around the world, and we still have a number of those sections quite active today.
Great. So your organization then is part of it's sort of an over-umbrella group for a variety of solar energy societies around the world. And you were recently in Korea at the Solar World Congress, which I assume is kind of the congress that you all put on. Can you tell me a little bit about what were the key takeaways from that event that you convened in Korea this year?
Yeah, that's right. The Solar World Congress in Korea is the continuation of our congress that we hold every 2 years. We've been holding since 1970. It represented a combination of technical presentations showing some of the latest developments in renewable energy, and particularly solar energy technologies, with a focus on photovoltaics and solar heating and cooling and concentrating solar power, and a little bit on building practices and some transportation. But the primary focus was on innovative research is being done in the solar technologies. But then in addition, we had cross-cutting forums and plenary speakers talking about what are the market opportunities, particularly in the Asian region, since that's where we were located. What are the opportunities being proposed or that could come out of the Paris talks? What are some of the financing opportunities that exist for private sector operating in this area? So there's quite a bit of combination of both technology advances as well as business opportunities discussed at the Congress.
So in addition to just good dialogue about these critical issues, was there any consensus as to what the most important things are that the United Nations and the groups and the countries, 196 countries or whatever that have made this agreement, what they could do to really advance solar energy?
Yeah, I think first of all, there's clearly an understanding that renewable energy represents the primary mitigation opportunity for climate change, and so there's a recognition now, especially as the prices have dropped, and the deployments have increased around the world, and the learning curve is continuing to show very positive, favorable direction. The outcome of the Paris negotiations really making it clear, sending a strong signal to governments around the world and to decision makers around the world, as well as to the financial community, that these technologies are ready for major deployment now, that they can create a significant and early contribution to reducing carbon emissions, and that economically they are not going to disrupt the global economy. In fact, that they have economic benefits that go far beyond what fossil fuels currently offer. So I think that it's important that the negotiators coming out of the Paris Accord put language in the final agreement that make sure that signal is available.
Okay, so while many of the listeners may know that after the basic agreement was agreed to in principle, but the final written document has not yet been approved. And so, as I understand it, Dave, you're basically saying that while obviously there's very positive news in this basic consensus that was celebrated in Paris, the devil is in the details, and some of the details that you're going to be looking at most closely are ones that make sure that solar technologies in particular are acknowledged for the power they have to be one of the most significant sources of carbon reduction and the necessary policies to encourage their deployment in countries around the world. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's correct. That's what we would like to have seen in the agreement. In reality, of course, the agreement is much more general, worded in a much more general way than that. It doesn't get into those kinds of specifics. But I think we could talk more about the final agreement that came out of Paris, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of the agreement.
Well, let's do that. Let's do that a little bit. I think that would be interesting to some of the folks on the call. I mean, obviously, everybody and their brother wants the agreement to identify their particular technology, or, in the case of the U.S. Green Building Council, we would have loved a paragraph about green buildings. That's clearly not the general approach of the document. It is intended to be more kind of outcomes-oriented as opposed to specific about all the specific technologies to be endorsed or not endorsed. What are some of the downsides to being as general as they are, or what are some of the things you'd like to see, recognizing that there was a delicate effort here not to, pick winners and losers?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think the agreement does, on the positive side, does provide a framework for action. But on the downside, you're correct, it's technology neutral. And, of course, that means that other technologies that I'm not sure are particularly going to be strongly supported as we go forward are like nuclear technologies are not. They could also be part of the picture the way the framework is currently phrased. We would have liked to see more specific language about the role that renewables can play and how renewable energy technologies can work together to provide reliable energy services around the world, and recognizing that, you know, the strong role that renewables are already playing in many regions around the world that have high penetrations of renewable energy technologies, such as some countries in Europe and some cities and some regions around the world.
Do you think the fact that some countries want to leave open all their options to ensure they have maximum energy to basically just catch up with the West, do you think that sort of, I mean, obviously folks from Europe that have done a really good job, especially Germany, with deploying solar, would love to see solar highlighted as the answer, given that they've made huge investments in it. But do you think part of that is an issue between the developing countries and developed, insofar as some of the developing countries want to have their rendezvous with coal for a little bit longer?
Yes, exactly. I think it's very much a key issue. And we know, for example, India in particular was concerned about having to take on a significant burden in reducing its carbon emissions when it's still trying to establish a solid electricity system in their country. And coal is going to be one of the answers for that for them certainly in the near future. And other countries as well. And of course, there's certain fossil producing countries that feel threatened by strong language that may show a rapid demise of that technology, of fossil technologies in the next decade or so. So they were resistant as well, and I think that's why.
But what do you think, what would have been some strong answers to their concerns about that? Obviously, this is a little bit after the fact here, but these are ongoing discussions, and it sounds as though your organization felt there could have been more done to accelerate the use of, or just to express that commitment, to accelerate use of solar, say, for example, in India. How do you answer people from the Indian government when they say, you know, we need to have more time to establish our overall grid and need to use the energy we have as opposed to the energy we'd like to have?
Well, I think the best that we can do, an important role that we can play is to share knowledge about how these emerging technologies really can work to provide substantial electrical services and energy services without having to rely on fossils going forward. I think it's still a perception out there that renewable technologies are too expensive and that their variability may create problems with the grid. But I think there's plenty of evidence to the fact that that's not necessarily the case, and that a lot of these countries probably haven't gotten effectively yet that information in the right way so they can take action on it.
Dave, I think that's a really great point. I think that's definitely a challenge with a variety of different types of alternative energy sources. And of course, in our world of green buildings, they're one of the most persistent misunderstandings relates to the perception that the cost has to be greater than a traditional building, and it's just simply not the case. So while you may have your work cut out for you overcoming some of those perceptions, that's a great point and a great value for your organization in providing the necessary education for folks to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, and I think the cost issue is really important. It's important to convey that there's a lot of externalities that are not factored into fossil fuel costs that should be factored in. And I think this is something that still has to be worked on. Some of the side events that I attended in Paris clearly pointed that out, that the externalities are not being factored in properly when fossil energy costs are compared with renewable energy costs. And of course, one of the solutions that is being proposed is strongly supported, I think, throughout most of the world, is to put a price on carbon and a meaningful price, something that really does help address the external costs that are not being factored in right now.
So that's likely to be something that will be addressed country by country, because there clearly is no consensus in this document or in the likely final documents. It seems like a lot of the smart money suggests that would be the single most powerful thing to do. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. It looks as though individual countries are going to be encouraged to advance that, maybe even coordinating amongst themselves, even at the non-national level, with big states in the United States collaborating with countries in Europe to create larger carbon trading systems. I know in Japan, Tokyo even has a carbon trading system that in effect puts a price on carbon. But it doesn't look like, as was the case coming out of the initial Kyoto climate agreements, that there is going to be a global price on carbon.
Yeah, I think that's the case. National governments are unwilling to take that on because in many cases, and such as here in the U.S., it looks like a tax, and so that's therefore doesn't have the right connotation. However, you did raise another very important point, and that is at the regional and local level, there is a lot of action that's already taking place, and that's what I find very encouraging coming out of Paris. I mean, the agreement has its shortcomings. Obviously, much of it is voluntary in nature, doesn't have mandates. And they agree to agree is basically what they've done, and to get together again every 5 years to see how they're doing. But I think when you walk around the vast rooms with all the booths and the side events, you see that there really is a lot of action taking place, especially at regional levels and local levels and at the business level. You know, certain businesses are taking action on their own. And that's very encouraging. I'm not sure how well the carbon reductions that are occurring by these progressive thinkers is getting factored into the negotiations, but it's clearly beginning to have an influence. I think there's clearly a lot of progress being made at some levels outside of the national governments.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the things that we struggle with at the U.S. Green Building Council is trying to find that right balance between mandates and actions that can be driven by markets. In other words, as seems to be the case now, solar is getting in many markets to be so much less expensive than it was before that it really has tremendous economic viability on its own. And there's a good argument to be made that until that is true in other markets, and there isn't this very intermittent sort of subsidy structure where you've got sort of mandates to do solar combined with healthy amounts, generous amounts of incentives, until you can move to a point where it really is driven by the markets, you aren't really going anywhere. That would be argument one. And then the other argument is that you really do need to produce a lot of upfront incentives in order to get these markets moving, which sort of sends the message to some people, if it has to be heavily subsidized, it must be very expensive and not economically viable. So it just how do you see that balance between kind of trying to encourage this through market forces versus sort of the top-down mandate approach?
Well, that's a good point. And obviously, subsidies is something that, to level the playing field, we'd like to have them treated equally across all technologies. And that's currently not the case, as we know, because the fossil industry also gets heavily subsidized in a variety of ways. But I think what really is going to be important here is that the markets are driven by what people want. And I think we're hearing more and more, and I think the Paris Accord sort of confirms this, that people want to see action taken on climate. And if they see technologies out there that address that goal that they have in their own mind, they will start adopting those technologies. And I think we're seeing that in many cases in the developed world. And I think that ultimately that will be the case in the developing world as well, that it's getting this public acceptance of these technologies that's really going to create the markets. And understanding that the economics are not going to turn out unfavorable by adopting these technologies. I mean, look at the auto industry, for example. The mileage mandates that are being imposed on the auto industry is actually creating new markets for new vehicles. And it's really, I think, it's actually an opportunity for the auto industry to develop new technology and in order to meet those mandates.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And as I say, it's all about balancing these different approaches. What I'd like to do in kind of closing out this discussion with you, one thing that I was very interested in about your organization and some of your goals also as its president was this focus on the intersection of dealing with climate change issues, but also with two other issues that can be complementary or can be advanced at the same time in a complementary way, which would be both poverty alleviation and energy security. Can you talk to those two very crucial issues, which I think would be particularly important in developing countries? And I noticed at this conference in South Africa that you were part of that those issues came up. And maybe you can talk about that. Of course, when we talk about people wanting things, generally renewable energy or energy of any kind, where it comes as part of a basic economic development strategy, that's when it can become most compelling. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, again, I think the solar technologies, because of the cost drops that have occurred, are now the least cost option in many cases for providing energy access to those unserved communities or poorly served communities. And as we know, there's 1.1 billion people that have no electricity services. And
sorry, you know, that's something that's a really interesting statistic that probably a lot of people don't know the exact. What do you know roughly what percentage that is of people on the earth that don't have access to any energy?
Well, let's see, 1.1 billion out of 7 billion is roughly 15%.
Wow. That's people to understand that because it is.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a good point. And many of them are in South Asia and in Africa. The majority of them are. And the majority of them are in rural populations. But even in the urban areas, there are certain populations that are unserved. So solar technologies, to me and to many people, now represent a low-cost option to provide that service. And we've seen that already through the millions of solar home systems that have been installed around the world, either through government donation programs, but even more effectively through private sector initiatives. So I think it's going to create a more distributed environment. And obviously, utilities have a difficult time with that, and the utilities prefer to just the major preference of governments in developing countries is still to try to extend the grid to unserved populations, but that's simply not going to be realistic in many cases. So I think continuing to promote these technologies for energy access, and also to, and at the same time, show the economic, environmental, and energy security benefits is, to me, the answer. And I think the grid extension of is still going to be an option in many cases, and ultimately that may be the best solution, but I think that there's going to be many unserved people that will not see the grid in their lifetime. And this is a way to get them access and to help grow their lifestyle and their economic payoff, I guess, or benefits.
Well, let me ask you this, because for a lot of folks, whether it's wind energy or solar energy, we're all able to recognize the commonsensical point that it isn't always windy, it isn't always sunny. The intermittent nature of these types of sources of energy is sometimes used to argue that they don't offer energy security. Can you talk to some of the new developments both in the storage world or other ways that you think this can be addressed short of it all becoming part of the macro grid?
Sure. I mean, I think the strongest area of innovation research that is being taken on right now is in the area of storage. There's technologies that are on the horizon that offer significant promise for having long-term, low-cost storage capabilities applied and large-scale levels. I think battery technologies are constantly improving. There's still issues regarding disposal of these batteries after their useful lifetime and environmental issues associated with that. But I think in terms of the innovation that's being called for coming out of the climate agreement, one of the areas that has to really get the most focus, in my opinion, is on the storage area, both thermal and electrical storage.
So on that point, I want to end our conversation. I'm very, very encouraged by your work, even when you were with the National Renewable Labs and we're doing work really pioneering in this area, to your right up to the date summary of what this means to folks coming out of the COP in Paris, and your continued leadership of the ICES, International Solar Energy Society. Dave, thank you so much for taking time with us, and I think you're giving us a very encouraging and positive message, and I hope people on the that are listening will follow up with your organization and others to make sure that we're keeping this progress going. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, no, I just want to thank you, Roger, for this opportunity to allow me to discuss what the work ICES is doing, and we look forward to working with you in the future and sharing this information as we go forward.
Great. All right, Dave. Thank you so much. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Climate Leaders. Join me next time for more insights from the world's climate experts as we explore the outlook for achieving COP21's bold objectives.